KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby.
This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. Welcome to a special edition of Civil Rights and Wrongs. I'm your host, Bob Daly, and once again, we are live in the co-op studios.
Yay. It's a little disconcerting, but yes.
I hardly know how to behave myself.
I know.
Now.
This is Co-op Spring Membership Drive. With me here in the studio is Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of the show, and Ken McKenzie Grant, a member of the Co-op Board of Directors. Ken's also a big fan of Civil Rights and Wrongs.
So. Always have been since you started it, and yes, I am. What can I say? I have my preferences as to co-op programs. I do tend to listen to all of them, but I have my preferences, my favorites, and Civil Rights and Wrongs. I'm just really proud of what you guys bring before our ears as Austinites who are paying attention to what's going on in the community and in the radio. And if you are like I am and you appreciate what happens here Tuesday nights from 6 to 7, please consider being the first in this only hour-long opportunity during our spring membership drive to call us right now. 512-472-5667 is the phone number to call if you'd like to make a pledge of support for what Bob and Michelle have brought and are bringing you now.
Well, thanks, Ken. And Michelle, how are you doing?
Pretty good. But like I said, it's a little disconcerting to be back here in the studio after all this time.
I know.
I mean, last time we did do the membership drive in the fall from here, but right. Still, it's different.
Yeah, my head's
used to all that. Yeah, I'm used to all that home crafting, you know.
Yeah. Yep. Well, let's get it set up right away. You're up first here this evening. We're going to do a best of here, by the way, this evening.
Mm-hmm.
What's the first segment about here, Michelle?
You've got queued up the segment we just did the beginning of last month, January. Well, actually, it's March now, so that would be the beginning of January.
Mm-hmm.
So we spoke to three guests who advocate for the rights of adoptees and work for changes within the U.S. adoption industry. Shauna Hodgson is an activist advocating for the rights of adoptees within the adoption, foster care, and assisted reproduction communities here in Texas, and she is an adoptee herself. Gregory Luce is an adoptee rights attorney that's based in Minnesota with expertise in adoption law and citizenship. He is also an adoptee. And Gabrielle Glazer is a journalist who examines issues surrounding mental health, medicine, and culture. She published a book in 2021 titled American Baby, A Mother, A Child, and the Shadow History of Adoption. This was the first time we'd covered this topic here on Civil Rights and Wrongs, so hope you enjoy. So I admit that until I heard the remarks made by Supreme Court Justice Amy Coney Barrett during the court's oral arguments a few weeks ago and, you know, made all the news circuits. And I happened upon on social media some rebuttal commentary made by several adoptees lambasting her, going further by delving into the long-held cultural perceptions of the practice of adoption itself based on their own experience as adoptees or familiarity with the processes through relatives. You know, I hadn't given much thought to these issues. I'm not adopted. It's not something that's touched my life in any way. I'm wondering if maybe each of you might be able to speak to that commentary from your own areas of knowledge and expertise, and possibly also address why it has taken so long for this questioning, or maybe it hasn't, and cultural shift in thinking around adoption and how it's become more widely heard and accepted within certain circles here.
For those of us that have been doing this work for a while, and of course, those of us who are adopted, we saw it coming. We weren't surprised by her comment, although extremely offended, we weren't surprised. And I think with adoption, you're looking at an industry that wants you to see adoption through an altruistic lens. So it's promoted as such. in the work that we do, we're constantly combating this narrative that adoption is this beautiful, wonderful thing, which it can be. But what we're really talking about is children who need homes that are parented by loving parents. And it's okay to say that's great, but it's oversimplifying the issue to say adoption is this wonderful, beautiful thing, because for many adopted people, it's not. And I think for all of us, you know, we were relinquished by our birth parents, and there's a trauma that comes with that. And then there's also additional traumas that we face as we become adults, when we're searching for birth parents, when we possibly are rejected by birth parents once we find them. And so the message to us from society and the industry and those who maybe are not, like you said, touched by adoption, is that it's a celebrated trauma, basically. You're celebrating the trauma of people whose lived experience is not just that of, yes, we were raised by possibly a loving adoptive family, but we also lost our original family. So adoption is most often accompanied by loss. And so in our legislative work, and we're trying to change laws to grant access to original birth certificates and original identities, but at the same time, we're constantly battling this adoption is beautiful narrative. And it's hard to educate the public when they're already looking at adoption through this lens of altruism and sometimes saviorism.
Right. And when you rock the boat, and what I mean by rock the boat is request very basic information about your own identity or your origin. This whole concept of adoption is simplified as a beautiful transaction in many ways really is pervasive throughout the entire industry, from the agencies that are involved to the courts that are involved. And that continues today, because if you request your information, one of the first stigmas that is thrown back in your face is that you are not sufficiently grateful for your adoption by loving parents, which has nothing to do with a really deep desire of many adoptees to know their origin and know their full identity. And that includes obtaining an original birth certificate, which has the factual circumstances of your birth. But in the majority of states in the U.S., there are restrictions on if you can obtain your original birth certificate. And like me, it took a 5-year court battle. And like Shauna, it took a great deal of effort to get that. But that's pervasive throughout your life. When you become aware that you have this other identity, that you existed in a different realm before you were adopted and lived your life with your adoptive parents. And once you find that out and start to request information that should rightfully be yours, these myths and thoughts about what adoption is sort of thrown back in your face. And you get actual anger sometimes from even court clerks who are wondering, why are you asking for this information? You really should be grateful and move on. So that's one of the stigmas that is built into being an adopted person in the United States. But it wasn't like this back in the day. I mean, Gabrielle can talk about the development of these laws regarding secrecy over time, but it didn't start until about 1935, when California was the first state to seal original birth records and make them unavailable, even to the adopted person when that adopted person became an adult. And that was in 1935. And that was as a result of threatened blackmail from people who would obtain their birth record because it was publicly available, and threaten the adoptive parents with telling the child that the child is adopted. So they closed that down, but they closed it down too strictly and made the birth record unavailable to the adult adopted person later. And then states began to follow California.
One thing, Greg, if you don't mind my jumping in here, is the operative phrase that you use is adoptive parents. The secrecy laws were established in the 1930s, as you just said, first in California. The export version of the law was that it would protect a child from the taint of his or her illegitimacy. It would protect a birth mother from the stigma of her wanton ways. But most importantly, it would reassure adoptive parents that no birth family would ever come to interfere with their newly created family. And that is, to me, the overarching idea behind how adoption has been portrayed basically for the last century. And it's really about, oh, look, this is something that is in the best interest of everybody involved. The adoptive parents are the best possible parents for this child. End of story. This is how the media have portrayed it. This is how popular culture certainly has portrayed adoption, with no recognition of the loss that accompanies first and foremost the adopted person, but also the birth family that in many cases, certainly in the post-war period where women were literally forced to surrender their children over to a predatory, very lucrative and exploitative adoption system.
It strikes me as being so shame-based. Life certainly has changed since the 1950s. Do you have any thoughts about that, about how societal views have shifted, and are any of the original presumptions about protecting the kid, protecting the family, are any of those still valid these days?
I think you're so right when you say it's shame-based. You hit the nail on the head. And as adopted people, we internalize a lot of that shame. These social mores that our mothers and all these birth mothers experienced at the time where, you know, being unwed and young or poor or whatever meant that they didn't deserve to be mothers. And the shame that was placed on them by society is oftentimes, if not always, internalized by those of us who were born to those mothers. In fact, we were called bastards. We were labeled illegitimate. In fact, we have an organization that we work with called Bastard Nation that has kind of taken back that name. That's been used against us for so many decades. And so as far as the societal views now, we see women having babies and deciding to be mothers as single mothers, as divorced mothers. That's not really an issue anymore. But I think when it comes to adoption, I think because adoption is seen as a practice, as a remedy for something that shouldn't have been or shouldn't be, because the mother was not prepared, or she didn't have the financial support she needed, or the emotional support she needed, or there was a religious reason. I think that still is going on. I think we still, as society, become judges of who deserves to be a mother. I think that's really the big question. And so in terms of an industry, are there maternity homes or women swept away and hidden during their pregnancies like they were in the past? No. But I do think that shame and that guilt and that societal view of women is still there. I think it's still hanging over us. And we saw that very much with Justice Barrett's comments, that it should be easy to just remedy the problem of an unwanted pregnancy and parenthood by, you know, basically placing your baby in a safe haven box or putting them up for adoption. We still aren't connected as a society to really just to women as human beings and to the needs of women as mothers.
That's it.
Nice.
How'd you feel about that show, Michelle?
It was very enlightening. As I said in the beginning of the intro there, the subject matter had not come to mind for me until I saw a social media discussion about it. So it was good.
A little off the beaten path, but very appropriate, especially for today. I want to thank you both for picking that to share from our best of this last year, because it's National Women's Month.
It is.
Is it international or only here in America?
I think it's international.
International, yeah. Women's Month. There you have it. And happy Mardi Gras, too.
Right.
So, laissez le bon temps rouler. But bottom line is, we are looking for your support, as we have only this 1 hour to raise money for this non-commercial cooperative radio station, as well as this particular public affairs program. And if it matters in your life, it has ever mattered to hear this from 6 to 7 every Tuesday, please call us now, 512-472-5667, or pledge online if you prefer not to be talky, kop.org. Just hit the donate button. And what we'd really like to do is thank you on the air if you come in, for example, at the $15 a month sustainer level. We'd be glad to give you the new co-op version of our black t-shirt, $100 one-time pledge of support for this program and this station.
Just who is co-op?
Yeah, who is co-op? Well, I know I'm co-op. I always have been. I think you two are co-op. And we have a new co-oper here with us tonight, too, don't we?
I think we do. Nassim's here with us tonight, right?
I am here, and I'm glad to be here. I love the topic that I just heard, and I'm just glad to be sitting on the show, guys.
Well, great. Well, welcome. You're considered an apprentice. Is that what we call you?
That's correct. I'm an apprentice right now.
Great. Well, welcome. I'm so glad you could join us.
Well, you are co-op. So
you are co-op.
There we go. We're glad you are, too. So anyway, as I was saying, we do have three different sustainer levels of membership, and I'm sure if you call us at 512-472-5667 that our phone answers, I'm going to double check in just a minute and let you know who they or he or she is, but they will let you know about our different levels of sustainer membership at the all-out, you know, max level of $50 a month, or if you'd prefer to give $325 one time, you'll get your choice of a Canvas Messenger bag, the new purple co-op cap, the black t-shirt, Who is Co-op, on it, and to be announced Friday evening here on the air, South by Southwest pair of platinum badges, which is the, you know, that's the max you can get. So all of those things can be yours if you sustain at the maximum level, but whatever you can afford, we really, really appreciate it, and thank you.
Well, thank you. And, you know, a lot of local restaurants support us during this pledge drive. Who are they, Nassim?
Well, Co-op Radio would like to thank the restaurants that generously donated meals from our volunteers this membership drive. Shout out to Counterculture, Thundercloud Subs, Smokin' Beauty, the ABGB, A-Plus Szechuan, Cherrywood Coffee House, and Veracruz Tacos.
All that and more.
Some of my favorites in there, you bet.
Well, let's keep moving along here. Our next selection is from February 8th. And from the Austin Justice Coalition, we spoke with Chaz Moore, who's the executive director and founder, and Chris Harris, director of public policy. AJC has been at the forefront of racial justice in recent years in Austin. And you may recognize Chris as a co-op veteran programmer and volunteer. So without further ado, we'll share that with you.
Trying to pull back and get some perspective on what all has happened, and so much has happened. The current climate that we're in, to me, is a little bit scary. The state legislature last year was about as regressive as it could get. Critical race theory, whatever that really means, has become a symbol for, well, really for white backlash. You know, you called it white lash before, I think. But we've got two laws now telling teachers what they can and can't say about slavery and the history of the U.S. We've got laws now prohibiting us from reducing police budgets. You know, whatever modest improvements or changes were made in that 2020 budget were quickly rescinded. We're fighting voting rights. Grassroots efforts are coming up with lists to prohibit books, 850 titles, anything dealing with racism or sexuality. And Trump seems to be totally unhinged now, using racist language and race baiting like he's never done before. So in this current climate, what's your take on things?
You know, it's just a lot going on, you know, but this isn't unlike, you know, any other moment in human history. You know, like, there's always multiple things going on as we talk about moving forward and building and creating more just, more equitable societies. I think it feels like a lot because, you know, especially this week with this current weather being where it is, like, this coldness is something relatively new for us folks in Texas, right? Like, we haven't been used to, like, this kind of sustained level of cold. And then you got the pandemic. But, you know, as far as the politics go, the stuff that's happening as far as voting and abortion rights and the ban on books, that's not new, right? That's very much of who the far right Republican Party has been, and very much, being honest, who we've been as a society, right? It's like, you know, again, and I said this a lot, with the pandemic, we had what I like to call like this 9/11 effect. Because I very vividly remember for about 6 months after 9/11, unless you were Muslim or Middle Eastern, we, the country, had come together in this kumbaya type of hoopla. And it was, you know, proud to be an American every morning at school and general sense of kindness and collectiveness around the country had just been like really, really great. And then 6 months later, we went back to who we were. And we kind of didn't change because we were being really, really terrible citizens and residents of this country to our Middle Eastern and Muslim brothers and sisters. Same thing with the pandemic, right? When the pandemic first appeared, you know, everybody's, oh my God, this is tragic. And we all did the right thing. Most of us, very large part, stayed in the house and getting our vaccines. And then a couple months later, what is this vaccine? And this is all a hoax. This is the government trying to tell us what to do with our bodies and all this foolishness, right? So it's just who we are. It's just who we are. And that's why, like, folks like us and Chris and other organizations that do system transformational work are in existence, because we're trying to create a new mode or mind frame or something, thought process for us, so we can just be better and do better as folks that are inhabiting this planet. But yes, like, does it suck that we're still talking about voting rights? Because I thought we got this settled back in 1964 and 5. Yeah, but yeah, you know, it just, you know, like, Chris is going to say something way more elegant and poetic and structured, but I'm just like, I'm not surprised by the shenanigans we're seeing. You know, like, Ted Cruz is saying it's racist that Joe Biden wants to get a black woman. It's just like, what? And this is the same guy that was in Cancun this time last year. You know what I mean? So it's this is us. This is who we are. And the only thing we can do is continue to get better and try to convert more people to the side of humanity and seeing all things that are good in humans and trying to do the right thing. And just know that there are going to be the Ted Cruzes and the Greg Abbotts in the world. And we have to collectively combat and fight against the ignorant and the hate and all the things that come with that.
Yeah, I mean, I really don't have much more to add to it. I would just say that right now, one, I think the forces that are pushing us backwards are very well organized, and they've gotten organized because they're able, through fear, they're able to whip their supporters into a fearful mindset. And they're able to do that because of the success that folks that are pushing for various, you know, justice in various realms, whether it's education, criminal justice, economic justice, and social justice, have had and continue to have. And so really, it's just a challenge for us all to continue to organize ourselves and to match or beat their level of organization. When we see folks take over a school board, take over a library board with designs on banning books and banning certain types of teaching in the classroom, that should not inspire us to fear. It should inspire us to organize to do the same. But obviously, for the cause of more justice, right, in our communities and where we live. But I agree wholeheartedly with Chaz. You know, unfortunately, there's always been an undercurrent of this, and people like this, and communities and leaders pushing for things like this. And so we have to shed our shock and get to work.
How about my co-op colleagues, Jim or Michelle? What's your take on what's going on right now?
I'm totally on board with what Chris and Chaz said. I think that we have to be really careful that we don't work ourselves into a dither and don't keep doing the organizing. I mean, you look at our history, people went through a lot worse stuff than we're going through. And we're here because of what they did and how they organized and the sacrifice that we made. And I think our job is just to keep going forward and to understand that what we're facing, the wall that we run into, that we can jump over it or we can knock it down, but it's a wall that people have faced all through history. And not to lose our desire for change or get frustrated or just throw up our hands. And I think this is a big problem, frankly, is this attitude that we see going around a lot that we've lost, you know, that they're there. But I think their being there means that we just have to keep working. And we got to have faith that what we're doing is going to pay out down the line. It's not probably going to pay out in the lifetime of many of us, obviously, but it will pay out in the long range, just as the people who went before us has paid out. So I think part of our job, Jesse Jackson said, keep hope alive and keep organizing. That's the second part of it. So I'm totally on board with their comments.
I was just going to add, yeah, the state of things these days has certainly just made me dig my heels in harder about educating myself further and making sure that the people around me are paying attention, because that's pretty much what we all need to do.
Welcome back to the studio. This is Civil Rights and Wrongs with Bob Daly and
Michelle Manning Scott
and
Ken McKenzie Grant. When I'm in music mode, I prefer Kenzie, but it's Ken McKenzie Grant and our new addition to the team tonight,
Nassim Toussaint, just sitting in.
Great. Glad to have all of you here. I was commenting while we're listening to that how Chas Moore really inspires me. He's a great guest and has a wonderful message, and we certainly wish them the very best.
Always.
So let's see. We were talking about Rocky before, right? For a good time. What number do people need to call?
Rocky popped in and said, "For a good time, call Rocky at the KOOP membership drive at 512-472-5667. You could pledge by hitting the donate button online at KOOP.org, but we would prefer that you call Rocky so that he can tell us your name and we can blame you on the air for whatever suits your budget.
Right. He's sitting back there on the phone right now, and we, as always, we're grateful for his promo during his show. He's always talking, saying good things about us.
Yeah, he gives us a good lead in to the hour here with us. So that's we really appreciate that from him.
And speaking of good words, we were talking about people who provided all the great food, and we left one off.
Yeah, Rocky also wanted us to be sure to add Eastside Pies to that to that list of places. So
yeah, there's two of their pizzas sitting out on the table out there right now.
Yes,
I it's not the one I walked in.
And they won't be there when we walk out at 7. It'll all be gone.
All right, well, let's move right along here. Next up are excerpts we did from a show on January 18th dealing with renters and the looming eviction crisis. We spoke with Shoshana Krieger and Mincho Jacob from BASTA and Joao Paulo Conley from the Austin Justice Coalition. Right. Yeah. So let's listen to what they have to say.
Wondering if you had any concluding thoughts about what should be happening or about what could happen in a better world.
It starts from the things that Shoshana and Mincho have already said, which is that organizing power and building relationships with your fellow tenants, building relationships with other renters in the city, and that strong network of solidarity amongst renters where we say, we're renters, we're here to stay, you know, we're going to be here for the long haul. We make up 55% or more of the residents of this city. We demand that our rights be guaranteed, you know, that our voices be heard and included in these processes moving forward. We insist on coming to the table and participating in future city policy discussions. And I think that if we could have that organized, united tenants' voice in this city, that would change a whole lot about what is a priority, how we keep track of data, how we monitor property management companies and landlords and ensure that tenants' rights are guaranteed. And I think that would be a great foundation, a great place for us to start to build from. And I would like us to see a lot of change that can't happen easily in this city because of the tremendous limitations that are imposed on us by the state. And the state really does a lot of harm to tenants. And Texas is one of the places in the country, I believe, where, you know, tenants have the least rights. But I think there are still things that we can do as a city and in Travis County. And there's a lot that we could do through organizing.
And I think right now we're at a precipice with our COVID eviction protections right now lapsing. And while the pandemic has exacerbated the housing crisis, there's been a housing crisis all along, and there's been an eviction crisis all along. There were 12,000 evictions in 2019, and we've managed to, with the protections, slow that to just over 1,500 in 2021. Right? Our world doesn't need to revert to the 12,000 in 2019. And we still have an opportunity to not have our world to go back. And we have an opportunity to re-envision and reimagine what housing stability looks like and what we as a community are going to do about our housing crisis, whether we are in a pandemic, which is going to worsen it, or not. This crisis is not because of COVID. This crisis is worsened by COVID, but this crisis is because of capital, it's because of lack of regulation, it's because of many, many structures, it's because of a lot. But we right now have because of COVID, instituted policies which have dramatically decreased the number of evictions. And there's still the opportunity to extend those policies. There's still the opportunity to say, we don't want to go back. And I think exactly as JP was saying, that in order to not go back, organizing is a crucial component of that.
You know, one of my favorite quotes on this show last year was from Gus Bova from the Texas Observer. I asked him a similar question, and his response was, to paraphrase it, that the real problem is that the people who are serving Elon Musk his coffee can't afford to live here. Mincho, did you have anything to add?
I think folks on this panel and yourself, you encapsulated that really well. I think just humanity too. I mean, if I was to think of a better world, it's one that we see the humanity of everybody, that we're all equal and that all folks are just struggling to have stability, to have a decent life, to be able to provide for their families. And we see it, Joe Paulo mentioned, was, you know, property managers that start looking at tenants as like, y'all are all trying to not pay your rent and you're lazy. And so like moves to eviction go faster, to all the folks in the system just looking at each other with more humanity, I think would go a long way and help us to change the system a lot and get rid of these exploitative measures that we see in every place that we look. So yeah, I'm happy to be working with all these folks, and for folks like yourselves that are putting voices on the air to expand on that a lot. So thank you for what y'all do.
Well, thank you. We're really grateful that the three of you could join us and certainly wish you the best. There's a lot of people really relying on you at this point.
I remember the live broadcast of that program not more than a month and a half ago, and it really opened my eyes, being a renter here in Austin. And if your eyes have ever been opened by what you're hearing here on Civil Rights and Wrongs, think about calling us right now, because we need to hear from you at 512-472-5667. Pledge your support. Michelle?
So are we jumping right into the next segment?
Just go right into it.
Okay. Next we're going to do is the show from November 30th, and we spoke to Benjamin Johnson from Loyola University of Chicago, and John Moran Gonzalez from here in UT Austin. They are co-founders of an organization called Refusing to Forget, and we will let you listen to what they have to say.
Yeah, so, listen closely. You may hear some things that
you've never heard before.
You've never heard before, and you should have heard when you were taking Texas history.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So we are about bringing to light and public awareness knowledge of some really horrific racial violence perpetrated against Mexican descent people, especially in Texas in the 19-teens. And we formed out of discussions between me and John and four other scholars who studied these events. They were very well known to specialists on the region and on Mexican-American history and Mexican-American studies. They really hadn't penetrated into popular consciousness, despite the fact that, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of people were killed and it had enduring consequences for Texas. So we shared our frustrations. And then in about 2013 or so, we realized that the 100-year anniversary of a lot of these events were coming up. And we wondered if maybe that was a chance to change that.
As Ben mentioned, it really was about kind of raising public awareness of these events, particularly in the context of contemporary events. As you may recall, that is the era of cases of racial violence, Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown, Sandra Bland. I mean, these cases of racial violence against communities of color reverberated for us with what happened 100 years ago. And so we wanted to bring them back to public consciousness as part of the discussion around these issues. And I will just add, I'm a native of the Rio Grande Valley, where much of this violence took place 100 plus years ago. And I did not learn about this until graduate school. The question of why I didn't know about it, despite its incredible importance for the history of the region, was central for me in joining the group.
You know, I guess some of us knew about this through family stories, right? Some of our collaborators, but for people like me and John, it was a similar experience. I was in my 20s. I had a BA in history. I had gone through Texas schools. I had taken seventh grade Texas history. My parents had done the same thing. And I'm living in New England in history graduate school, you know, in my mid-20s. And I'm only now finding out about this. And it just seemed like totally wrong, right? I wanted to know about it. And I also wanted to know like the backstory about why I didn't know about these things, why I knew more about, you know, New York City and the Civil War or Chicago in the 19 teens than I did about the very state that I was from and was studying.
The one incident that people do seem to be hearing about these days is Porvenir. Could one of you speak to the specifics of what happened there?
So yeah, it's the worst single incident, right? And it happens in 1918. It's out in West Texas in Presidio County. And there is a small but proud and independent, you know, Mexican farming ranching community in Porvenir, Texas, which hauntingly enough means future, right? So that which is to come. And there had been a raid on a local ranch, the Bright Ranch, previously. So that raid happens in late 1917. And then it's a little mysterious how this gets put into action, but there's a company of Texas Rangers, which has been stationed in the valley and had been commanded by someone who had overseen many of these killings and this kind of ethnic cleansing and dispossession of Mexican descent people. He's sent out there. And so a ranger company in conjunction with one unit of U.S. cavalry comes into this village in January of 1918, separates a group of 15 men and boys, right, some of whom are teenagers, from the rest of the village. And they are lined up against a bank and shot, and their bodies left out. So it's the largest single event of mass killing that we have from these events. And it was the one at the time that caused the most notoriety and particularly led to J.T. Canales, who was the only non-Anglo-American in the state legislature at that time, to break with the Rangers. He had been working behind the scenes in South Texas, in the valley where he's from, to try to prevent the worst of these atrocities, and had even been basically getting U.S. Army units to deploy in Mexican descent communities to protect them from the Rangers, because in the valley, the Army was much more even-handed, to the point where actually Army commanders were complaining to the governor and threatening to put South Texas under martial law to restrain the Texas Rangers because they were so appalled by the conduct and so concerned that it would actually set off retaliatory violence. So Porvenir is a really kind of a turning point, and Canales files a set of charges then at the end of 1918 against the Rangers, and that sets the stage for a really kind of dramatic hearing and sort of showdown with the Ranger force in January of 1919, which is as close to any kind of accountability or public reckoning that happened either at the time or really, honestly, in the intervening century.
As you mentioned, it sets off the legislative investigation of the Rangers, which has 1,600 pages of eyewitness testimony. And despite all this evidence, there were no indictments, much less convictions, of Rangers. It was common practice for Rangers so accused to simply resign and join some other law enforcement agency, like at the county level, or later the Border Patrol. So essentially, there was a revolving door for law enforcement. They would just shuffle from one agency to another without any consequences. The other point about the Canales investigation is, on one hand, it was a development that groups like the League of United Latin American Citizens would adopt. That is, recourse to the legal system to attempt to enforce Mexican-American civil rights. And this was really the first time the state was forced to reflect upon the actions of its own agents. On the other hand, there was little accountability, or none, I should say. There was a bill passed to reform the Rangers, downsizing them. But really, the signal was one that the Rangers could largely still operate with impunity. And certainly, Ranger violence would continue for decades to come. You know, I think the absolutely essential to mention that the Texas Rangers also were hugely involved in the violence against and removal of Native peoples from Texas. And they were slave catchers in the 19th century who would often cross into Mexico in pursuit of folks who sought their freedom. And in the 20th century, they were directly involved in efforts to resist desegregation of schools in East Texas. Clearly, their mission, as it were, was to uphold white supremacy in these instances. And I don't think there's really any getting around that.
And there's also a class element here, too. So in the Canales hearings after Poor Vanier, you also get a lot of complaints from farmer and labor organizations, even those that are predominantly white, about the use of rangers and the use of state violence to break them up. It's interesting now when we talk about these things, I feel like we talk about them with everybody knowing, or we talk about them kind of under the shadow of the sweeping debates about police violence and violent policing in the United States today. I always sort of thought of this in my mind as a particularly Texas thing, but the events of the last 5 or 6 years have made me realize so many of these issues are basically inherent to policing just across the board in the United States, right? So one of the things Canales wanted to have done is that officers needed to post a bond so that they could be held financially liable if they abused the law. And he wanted people who had been violent to be fired, and he wanted them to be criminally prosecuted. And those are exactly the calls today from advocates of police reform. We're not going to have equitable and nonviolent policing in the United States until police officers who engage in violence are actually held accountable, both in terms of employment and in terms of the law.
Is it a coincidence that all of this happened about the same time as a severe uptick in anti-Black violence in the U.S., especially immediately post-World War I?
Yeah, no, it's not coincidental at all, right? I mean, that horrific practice of lynching, particularly the kind of public way designed to create a spectacle of dehumanization and humiliation against Black victims, like that's designed to shore up Jim Crow and to keep Black people in a subordinate place. And it's a variation on that theme, right? Or a similar pattern that you see in the borderlands. And there's a similar kind of culture of lynching. And this is what our colleague Monica Martinez talks about in her book, The Injustice Never Leaves You.
Whew, I'm still catching my breath after that.
Intense conversation, Bob. Thank you.
Yeah. I think that was one of our best shows. Some of our best guests.
Brought me to the verge of tears.
You know, Ken, you were mentioning the archive. So I've got about 2 years worth of our shows on a separate archive from Co-op. And you can get to that by going to the show's homepage. So go to co-op.org and look up the shows, and you'll find Civil Rights and Wrongs. And on our webpage, there's a bunch of links there to our shows. And it'll take you to the archive. It's bobdaily.podbean.com, I think is.
Because there's a lot more where this came from, and we want you to know that. I know you guys are concerned. You are conscious of what's going on. For just a quick minute, I wanted to talk to those of you who are non-mainstream music fans, such as the program right before this one, Chateau Daddio, one of my favorite music shows on Co-op with Rocky, who's ready to take your phone call in support of us, by the way. But if you're a music lover and an activist, both, any shade of both of those, we are talking to you now. And you might as well get used to the fact that, I think we're all used to the fact that unpleasant sociocultural history pops up only when people seek it out. And it's not always pleasant. Sometimes it's painful to hear, but it's really important to know who we are, where we came from, and where we're trying to go.
Right.
So thank you for this program, for sure. All you've done.
And if people are really grateful, what should they do?
Call us right now. Like I say, Rocky's ready to take your pledge, 512-472-5667. Please do include any comments or references or the fact that you like maybe a lot or all of our news and public affairs programs in addition to Civil Rights and Wrongs, because we do have several that are really impactful. And if it matters that they stay in Austin, you need to help us sustain it with a pledge of support. Please donate online. Hit the donate button at kop.org if you don't feel particularly talky. But we would love to thank you on the air. And thanks to those of you who've supported us in the past.
So we've got one more recorded segment tonight here, and that's from Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. Austin's been a real gift to this show and showed up right around the time of the pandemic for us. So he's been closing most of our shows. We spoke with him last Friday. He typically covers Austin City Council, Austin Police, or any number of issues. So we'll listen to that right now.
It's Friday afternoon, February 25th, and once again, we have Austin Sanders with us, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How you doing on these cold days, Austin? You staying warm?
Yeah, I'm doing my best, staying inside mostly, but am staying warm.
Well, things are a little hot for 19 APD officers since last week, I imagine. I think the indictments were unsealed, if I have that right, correct?
Yeah, unsealed and released by Travis County District Attorney Jose Garza about a week ago, which gave us a little more insight into the charges brought against these 19 Austin police officers for behavior during the 2020 Black Lives Matter protest at the end of May in Austin.
And you and Brent Bingaman did an article about that very subject, right? About use of excessive force. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so basically 19 officers were charged with two counts of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon. One for aiming the weapon at people in a way that threatens bodily injury, and one for actually firing the weapon that caused serious bodily injury. And again, these weapons are shotguns that have been modified to shoot these bags that are filled with lead pellets, right? Basically, they're commonly called beanbag rounds in the public, but they're beanbags filled with lead pellets, and they can be very damaging. Several people suffered severe injuries. Two at least have suffered permanent lifelong injuries that can really impair their way forward. So I just want to stress that, you know, these charges indicate that they are deadly weapons, and they certainly have the capability of being deadly. These are first-degree felonies because they were allegedly committed by on-duty police officers, right? So when public servants commit this specific crime, it's considered a first-degree felony, which is punishable by 5-year to 99-year prison sentence and a possible $10,000 fine. And all of these 19 officers were booked into the Travis County Jail and then pretty quickly released on bond. Pretty low bail for some, just $1, but some had to put down $5,000 for their bail. So yeah, this is a pretty extraordinary development in this local and national effort from progressive prosecutors to hold police departments and police officers accused of misconduct liable or accountable, rather, in ways that we're not really used to seeing in America. We estimate that this is the highest number of officers facing criminal indictment from excessive use of force during these 2020 protests that really swept the nation, right? No other city has come close to even doing that. So yeah, it's a significant development. And of course, it has really riled up the local and state police lobby, as we have discussed before, have kind of waged a campaign against Travis County DA Jose Garza, the way that other police groups have done in other cities where voters have elected progressive prosecutors.
Ultimately, though, there's not a whole lot that they can do against Garza, right? Could they bring some sort of lawsuit against him, maybe? Or?
Well, they've tried in other criminal cases brought against police officers, because again, this is just, you know, 19 officers. Garza has indicted police officers in other cases. Probably, you know, the most kind of highest profile that we've talked about is Christopher Taylor, who's been indicted on two separate murder charges. And in some of these cases, the defense attorneys have tried representing some clients before the DA's office. They filed motions in court to dismiss cases against their clients, citing the DA's mishandling of cases, that he has withheld evidence. Thus far, these efforts have not been successful in any meaningful way. Defense attorneys who have gone up against Garza have tried to have cases thrown out based on what they allege is misconduct or just at least shoddy prosecution, but that has been unsuccessful. Primarily, they are waging a public relations campaign. These two defense attorneys, Ken Irvin and Doug O'Connell, represent a number of police officers facing criminal prosecution from Garza's administration. And they, along with the Austin Police Association, and as we've talked about before, CLE, the statewide police union group, have again waged this real PR battle against Garza, holding press conferences, leaking news to the media, talking to the media about the way, as they characterize it, that Garza is not conducting these grand jury proceedings in the way that they perceive as fair. Grand jury proceedings are sealed. Garza can't talk about them. The defense attorneys can't talk about them. But what they say is some expert witnesses are not being called to the stand to talk to the grand jury. The officers themselves are not being called to the grand jury. Of course, they're not alleging any kind of unethical or criminal behavior on behalf of Garza. DAs have full discretion in how they present cases to the grand jury. And Garza, for his part, says, you know, these are full and complete evidentiary hearings that we're giving before the grand jury, where we are presenting fair cases. But yeah, to kind of answer your question, it's mostly just been a PR battle, trying to disparage and discredit Garza and his administration to try and dampen the influence he's had thus far.
I suppose maybe smear campaign is a little too strong, but certainly a challenge to him.
Right.
Well, we'll certainly be watching that case as we have been for some time here. You did mention a couple of cases of protesters who were pretty seriously injured. I don't suppose that would have anything to do with the two settlements a week ago that city council approved.
Yeah, and lawsuits filed by Justin Howell and Anthony Evans, two of the most grievously injured protesters that day. Howell received an $8 million settlement and Evans a $2 million settlement. So we talked about some really significant amounts. And in fact, the officers who shot Howell and Evans were included in these criminal indictments. They are the officers facing charges for those two shootings. So yeah, certainly there's still more to cover on this story.
Well, we'll be airing this on Tuesday, March 1st, which will be the co-op spring membership drive. And you are certainly a big draw for this show, Austin. We are always grateful for your contributions. I know from meeting you and speaking to you offline that your heart is definitely in your work. So we're very grateful for everything that you do for the city and by extension for Co-op Radio. So thank you so much.
Well, I really appreciate the kind words, Bob. It's always a pleasure to take some time and chat with you about these stories. As I've said before, I've been on a couple of times to talk more in depth about stories, but even these quick updates about City Hall, I know are of value to your listeners, and I'm glad to do it for Co-op. It's a vital community asset, the station and then your show. So I'm glad to come on and I appreciate you inviting me.
Well, thanks so much. And of course, we'll look forward to talking with you next week.
Yeah, I'll be back. Thanks.
Austin Sanders, as we hear most every week, Tuesday from 6 to 7 here on Civil Rights and Wrongs. And once again, this is your last call and the last time you'll have an opportunity, because we won't be here next week asking for your support. It's an opportunity for you to call us at 512-472-5667 or make your donation online at this moment as you stream from KOP.org. Hit that donate button and let us know that the content that Bob and Michelle are bringing you every Tuesday night has made and maybe will make a difference in your life. Please call us.
If you are not Co-op, who is? And that's right. But you know.
Yeah, who is Co-op?
Who is Co-op? You are Co-op.
Right.
You obviously care about your community. That's why you're listening tonight. That's one of the reasons. So.
And Nassim, what a pleasure to meet you tonight and to have you here. I guess you've listened to us a few times before.
I have, and it was a pleasure to meet all of you.
I've listened to the show a few times and I always learn a lot. So I know that right after this, I'm definitely going to go listen to that archive. I encourage everyone to do the same.
Yeah, there's a lot of good stuff in there, not only from the last 6 months, which we picked for tonight, but going way back. I think we've got it going back about 2 years now. I think it pretty much coincides with the pandemic, you know? So
it does. Yeah. And if you appreciate not having been shut down by your ears anyway, please give us a call. We need your support right now.
Right. Yeah, we do.
Right. Well, it's been a real pleasure to be here live and in person again.
And we got to thank Rocky for standing by the phones for us. Thank you so much, Rocky. And we got a shout out to Jim Harrington. Sorry he couldn't be here tonight, but he is.
I'm so glad you included Jim's voice, as always.
Yeah, he's an integral part of the show.
Also, thanks to Eastside Pies again, as well as Nassim.
Thank you.
Yes. And we were just bantering before. This music that we're hearing is a piece by an artist called Komiku. And it's Fleur l'Horizon, I think, if I've got my French pronunciation.
Or as we like to call it, the co-op. I mean, as we like to call it, the Civil Rights and Wrongs theme song.
Right. So we'll just go out with that. And again, thank you so much. They're still answering the phone back there, 512-472-5667.
Or co-op.org.
Co-op.org. That'll do, too. All right. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you for listening to KOOP Hornsby Austin 91.7 FM, community radio for Austin since 1994. Co-op continues our 24-hour stream of music and local programming at koop.org, where there is also more information on our diverse programming schedule. Find us back on 91.7 FM tomorrow morning beginning at 9 a.m. Until then, KVRX Student Radio for UT Austin will broadcast on this frequency. Thank you for being part of your community radio station. Radio for people, not for profit.
KVRX HD3 Austin.